Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 27 of Real Talk. I was away for the last couple of weeks. I took my family to Europe, London, Provence, and Paris, and nothing like traveling throughout Europe with an 8 and 6 year old. I had a few meetings in London. We are actively working with European-based groups, Middle Eastern groups, Asian groups, Indian groups, who are looking to put money out in U.S. real estate. And so it was interesting having meetings in Europe, understanding their market, from their perspective. Things have been slow since 2016, from Brexit to COVID to now today, of what their economic conditions are, which seem to be worse off than what we're experiencing in the U.S. And thus, we are making strategic introductions among our client base who do deals in the U.S. with British, European, and other international capital providers. On this episode of Real Talk, I interview Brett Dado, the founder of Dado Properties. Brett, who's a good friend and client, has a great story. He is a Los Angelino through and through. His family, third generation, maybe even fourth generation of Los Angelino, with his grandfather, Rod Dado, being the legendary baseball coach for USC, who won countless national titles in the 60s and 70s and 80s, led USA Baseball to Olympic gold medals, and at the same time built a logistics company, a trucking company, who Brett then catapulted into a much larger industrial company, and was one of the first to go into cold storage and industrial outdoor storage, commonly known as IOS, and has been extremely prolific in the industrial market in Southern California. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brett Dado.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good buddy, Brett Dado, president, managing member of Dado Properties. Brett, how you doing this morning?
Great, good to see you, Andrew.
So, Dado Properties, the Dado family, guys are institution in the city of LA and definitely in the LA real estate community. For my audience that may not have heard of Dado Properties, can you give them an overview of what you guys do?
Sure. And hey, thanks again for having me on. Been a bit admirer of watching you kind of your career blossom and everything you've done, and listened to one of the podcasts. Well done. So excited to be on. And I'm hoping this maybe gets out to some of the younger executives and people or kids out there that might kids, people in college, what have you, and some of this advice might help them as they're trying to advance their careers and so on. Our logo is a baseball, with a globe of the world. And I guess that where that came from was my grandfather, Rod Dado, who I literally was kind of interesting to start your company with your grandfather. His background, and this was back in 05, 06, but his background is he played baseball at USC, went on to play professionally and got up to his dream, which was playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and only got to play in about 4 games before he broke his back and ended his career. And that was during the Depression. So one way to make some money during the Depression was to buy if you could afford to buy a truck and drive it, to I think it was in Albuquerque, a midway point, kind of halfway across country and things of that effect. So he started doing that, built up a transportation company you know, he was a charismatic guy and a natural leader, and built that into a national platform. At the same time, I think during World War II, his coach was unable, had to go serve. Rod, my grandfather's injuries and things couldn't do it. So then he took over coaching the USC baseball team. So he was building up his transportation business. He had gotten in with Sears, which was a Walmart or Amazon of the 1950s, handling a lot of their logistics, and got in with GE and others. Kept building up that platform on the logistics side while coaching baseball. And even though he's known, I think he, you know, had the fortune of winning 11 national titles as a collegiate baseball coach at USC. But I think he was almost more proud, or as proud, of really getting baseball going internationally. So he went over with the commissioner of baseball at the time, Bowie Kuhn, and the O'Malley family at the time that owned the Dodgers, to really get baseball started in Japan and in Asia and other countries around the world, kind of using baseball. So he coached the 64 Olympic team in Tokyo and the 84 Olympic team here in Los Angeles, but is really kind of using baseball is to reestablish relationships between countries and culturally through sport. And I know you were yourself were a tremendous collegiate baseball.
Oh yeah. Player. Oh, so tremendous
to know that.
You know, I gave up my aspiring professional career so I could have this podcast and talk to you, Brett.
That's a little bit of the history and the logo and the baseball, and then through that. You know, Rod had grown up. He was as an entrepreneur. Why pay rent to somebody else who was buying buildings really for the use of the logistics platform and built up a portfolio? So really kind of started the company with him, with a focus on logistics real estate, primarily in Southern California and Northern California.
I want to talk more about the company and the history of the company and what you're doing today, but just. How, to the extent you had conversations with your grandfather or maybe your dad who knew more about his allocation of time towards being such a prominent figure in baseball and collegiate baseball, and not just, you know, coaching a team that, you know, had moderate success. And like you said, 11 national championships, some of the biggest names in baseball, from Randy Johnson and Mark McGuire. And I think did Tom Seaver go to USC?
Tom Seaver, my dad's roommate, God bless his soul.
Wow. Oh, wow. So, I mean, how was he able to have such a successful and thriving college baseball and just international baseball career at the same time growing a logistics transportation company?
You know, I mean, I think to have success in both, there's one thing I just learned from him is he loved people and was a people person. I think that helps anybody. You know, again, we're going to go to the younger people in the audience, just kind of have success connecting with people. He loved what he did. His enthusiasm really shone through. And so I think, you know, whether it was the players on the field or customers out there, building up trust and rapport and bringing a lot of energy and enthusiasm, what he did. But, you know, I think what I learned from that, when I spent some time for him, I didn't work for him my first year out of undergraduate business school at USC. And it was just time management. I mean, very focused, very disciplined on, you know, he got up early, had agendas. Remember, like, we would host customers I was right out of college coming in for a guy who was playing your school, that great Rose Bowl victory for the Trojans against Northwestern.
Yeah.
We had a lot of, business going out of Chicago with Sears and others, and those executives were coming in. It was like the day before, and here I'm this young guy, it's New Year's Day. So, of course, I've been out with my then girlfriend celebrating New Year's Eve with our group of just right recently out of college friends. And you know, but the day before that, I had to go and do a dry run with him, where the RV was going, where we're going to park at the Rose Bowl. I'm driving down the Rose Bowl, the exit strategy of how we're getting out to avoid traffic, how we're getting back to where these guests are, where I'm picking up the hotel. You know, I had to do that the next morning on New Year's Day after being out so many years. I had to be at his house in Glendale at 5 a.m.
Oh, my. I bet.
He's out there waving his baseball cane because I got there 5 minutes late. Tigers in comedy, where you're late. Where are we going? I'm like, man, it's 5 a.m. Like, you know, nobody's gonna be ready. But he was, you know, he was prepared, he was focused. I know one thing he did was kind of a thing, you know, he had did have little nap rooms in both his offices at the logistics company and at USC, because he'd get up at 5 a.m, 4 a.m, whatever it was, you know, and run the business and then leave midday, early afternoon over to USC and then work there until it was late into the evening. So he wouldn't sleep a lot. Traditional mountaineering at night, I think it was like 4 hours or so a night, but then take 2-3 cat naps or something during the day.
Wow. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's to think of how much you can accomplish in a day if you just have good time management. Two asides that I want to talk about, and then let's get into what you guys are doing now. One, that Rose Bowl game. I for me personally, I say the two greatest sporting events that I've ever been a part of, Kirk Gibson, or that I've attended, Kirk Gibson's home run in 88.
That was, yeah, remember that clearly. Yep.
And for me, being a Northwestern student athlete in 95, the 96 Rose Bowl, seeing the Rose Bowl packed with purple all over, playing USC, growing up in LA, knowing how big the Rose Bowl is for those in LA, even though we lost that game. I mean, to me, that was just a magical day, perfect day, sunny day in Pasadena.
I remember clearly too. And, you know, really, that was all Keyshawn Johnson that game. That
I know.
Was like, he was unstoppable that game. So,
Brad. Yeah, no, that was not now. But now USC gets to finally play with the big boys and be in the Big Ten in a year or so. And we'll see how they like faring against Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, Wisconsin, and Northwestern. So, Brett, I'm inviting you right now. Their first trip out to Northwestern, they've already said, in 2024. So I'm hosting. We'll all go out there and we'll see the Trojans take on the Wildcats, the revenge game from the 96 Rose Bowl.
I love it. Count me in.
Okay. And finally, the last thing on your grandfather, and I do want to talk about your foundation, but I remember as a boy, so passionate about the Dodgers. The offseason seemed like it took forever. And the first game every year, in the 80s, when I was, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, before they left to go to Vero Beach for spring training, there was a Dodger game against USC at Dodger Stadium in like late January or early February. And all the Dodgers were playing in that game, like Garvey and Say and Lopes and Steve Sachs. And they'd play the USC team. Coached by your grandpa.
It was a great tradition. I mean, there was a really close relationship. You know, my dad played baseball for Tommy Lasorda in like AAA Ogden, AA or something that, you know, when he was trying to work his way up, didn't make the majors, my dad or uncle or cousin, well, played in Dodgers minor leagues, but Rod made it up. But then close relationship with the O'Malley's at that time, Tommy Lasorda and my grandfather were best of friends.
Yeah.
He used to come to USC and scout because SC had, was like a minor league farm team. USC had so many great players, so he would come and scout, and plus he coached my dad. So they became close. So through all those relationships, USC got that thrill. I remember doing that a lot as a kid, of getting to go out there and play, you know, Dodgers and so on. My dad, actually, when he was coming up through the ranks, a lot of those guys, Bill Russell and Steve Garvey, the guys were guys that he initially played with who went on to the big. So remain good friends of the family today. And in fact, it's great is back Steve Garvey, recipient of the Rod Dato Award for our for everything he does, gives back to the community for. And so as Tom Lasorda was our initial winner of the Rod Dato Award, which is what we do in honor of Rod to keep his spirit alive and all the things he did to give back to the inner city and inner city kids, where we provide, college scholarships and field renovation work. And doing it to a sport that you now love. We do it. It's going to be this year, October 30th at Riviera Country Club. And it's kind of a celebrity program. We get a lot of the big, luckily with our partnership with the Dodgers and their foundation. We've got a lot of ball players there, and actually from various different sports nowadays, a lot of baseball. And that's great. Billy Butch is our MC, and a lot of great guys come out. So that'll be October 30th. Anybody wants more information on that? That's at datofoundation.org.
Yeah, I've played
Legends of the Links.
Yep, I've played in it and sponsored it, and you count me in for this. I'm glad you moved it up a couple of weeks. It always, like the last couple of years, have coincided with my daughter's birthday of November 12th, and now this year it's October 30th. So
we didn't want to risk that rain we got last year, and we figured more before the time change and maybe a chance for better weather.
Oh, perfect. All right, I'm in, and look forward. It's always a great event, and such a great cause. It's near and dear to my heart of spreading baseball and providing assistance to those that inner city for field renovations and everything else that you do for them. All right,
appreciate the support.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about Dado Properties today. Obviously, you guys are focused on industrial, and so just talk about the company, talk about the types of deals that you've been doing here in Southern California.
Sure. You know, I mean, to me, is one thing I learned, right? I came out of the entrepreneur program in undergrad business school, and I was kind of ringing my head about trying to find a niche, you know, something and taking a deeper dive and trying to, you know, it's like, do I go try to compete head to head with Prologis or the big REITs as a startup younger company? I was like, you know, it's going to be challenging, you know, so where are some opportunities? And coming from a family logistics company, and at the beginning, some of the fees we'd make to keep the company alive would be asset managing the family portfolio, which included truck terminals and trailer yards, as well as distribution buildings. And then we did a lot of food related work. Dart still does a lot of the supermarket chains. So when I began the company, a lot of focus was on cold storage. There's some cities in near downtown LA, like the city of Vernon, which has its own power, which is a lot cheaper than Edison's power. So therefore power is, you're a big consumer in a cold storage building. We've got gigantic freezers and coolers running 24/7, 365. As a tenant, you're gonna be very focused on your power cost and utility costs. So the Arts District was starting to boom in downtown LA. Those properties went way up in value compared to other industrial property submarkets in the region. So we started bringing, these guys are kind of a boom and like, wow, I can't believe my property just went up three times in value from where it was a few years ago. But they were in antiquated facilities that were functionally obsolescent. So I was pitching a lot of those firms on, I'll build you a state-of-the-art cold storage building in Vernon, which has its own police and fire, more attentive than I felt than the city of LA to their needs, safer environment. Not only in the power is cheaper, but also newer equipment was a lot more energy efficient. And a lot of these companies were under pressure by their big suppliers, the Costco's or Walmart's of the world, to be under compliant with new food safety regulations. And the older buildings would be very difficult to comply with those. Literally some of these buildings down in the downtown LA produce and fish markets are like 100 years old and things. So I started getting into that niche and just, I'm going to understand cold storage deeply. Ended up bringing in one of my first hires, a guy who had worked in the wholesale food industry and then transitioned into some real estate and jumped with me. So we really understood it. So we took a deep dive into that and built some produce buildings, food production buildings, food distribution, bought the LA Food Center from Lowe's, which was one of the bigger downtown LA food distribution buildings with our first institutional partner as we started bringing in institutional capital.
So what time periods are we talking about?
So this was, I think, you know, we started construction on our first cold storage build-to-suit project in 2005.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's when we started that. And wasn't all we were doing was cold storage. We're also doing some traditional distribution, but with a heavy focus on cold storage. Then I'd say when we got into the financial recession of 2008, 2009, through my doing some asset management work to create fee income, because I'm not developing much then, but at least I had some income from my agreement to asset management, the Dart Warehouse Corporation, that's the family logistics arms to asset manage their buildings. A little more free time on my hands than I wanted to during that phase when the market was very slow. So we had a large truck terminal coming up for the lease was expiring. And their director of real estate was going around the country. I remember him flying in from Dallas and just saying, every landlord's got to give me a 20% reduction in rent. So I just took a deep dive using that we knew other people in the logistics business or people we'd done business with, and they also own truck terminals. I started going out meeting with them. What are you getting for rent in yours and how you're calculating and what's struggle advice? So I started putting a whole book together of how many truck terminals were even in existence, how many became available at any one time, just digging in and put together this book that I ultimately showed this director of real estate. And I, you know, I basically kind of made the case. I understand what you're doing. You're going around the country, but I go, I'm going to make the case now. And you can look at all this data and all this information I have that I think you're already 20% under market. There is no other truck terminal available. So I don't know where you're going to move. And there's probably nothing, there's nobody builds these spec and anything else. It's kind of this, you know, dive in. And so ultimately flew back to Dallas and other things. We weren't seeing eye to eye the first meeting or so, and came back and we agreed. He goes, you're right, no reduction on rent. In fact, I want to do a 10-year extension on this with annual increases and all that. And I go, yeah, there's something here. And then I started focusing, which is now known, it's kind of become a darling of the institutional world, is they call IOS, Industrial Outdoor Storage, which has become a big niche within the industrial or logistics properties, which is a focus on these really key parts of the supply chain, high throughput warehouses that have a lot of doors, a lot of excess trailer parking, truck terminals that are transloading type facilities, or just really a long skinny dock, typically only 80 foot wide. So you're not storing product, it's getting loaded in and out of trucks and moving very quickly. And the dock is usually empty at the end of the day.
Can we drill down on IOS for a second? Because I would say, maybe 18 months ago, maybe it was even 12 months ago, I started hearing IOS. And I'm thinking they're talking about, you know, our phones and the operating software. And sure. Now in the last 12 to 18 months, I've done, you know, 10, 15 IOS deals, maybe even more. And everyone's talking about IOS. So why is it today that this sub asset class within industrial is so hot? And it's not just private capital, it's even institutional capital that wants to get in on this sub asset class.
Yeah, well, I think there's a recognition. You need different zoning, heavy industrial zoning. Even a typical city that might have a large base of industrial, maybe a smaller percentage of it, is a heavy industrial that's required for these uses that are, you know, that are going to have, you got to do a traffic study and things would be more impactful to the infrastructure of that city. There's a lot more trucks and things on the road. So that it, you know, in today's regulatory environment, particularly in the state of California, where it's already challenging to get projects approved, there's a lot of eyes on industrial because the amount of growth of projects that have gone up over the past decades. So I think this recognition as people took a dive in, particularly during COVID, when we had a lot of supply chain issues, that these were really needed facilities, that they were hard to find, and that there were a lot of cost efficiencies for the retailers, to consumer manufacturing companies and logistics companies that to utilize these facilities, and particularly as a shortening at different times, there's been kind of a shortening of although during COVID companies did get a lot more inventory, but I think in the retail and other worlds, there's a lot quicker turn of inventory. Those types of facilities facilitate that, and on the terminal and transloading side, there's just been a big lack of trailer parking. You can't really park the trailers and things down at the ports like you used to be able to. I think for a lot of those reasons, I think that then the institutional and the real estate market started picking up on something that we've been strategically, trying to find the right partners on, trying to convince a bank to give you a construction loan to build a speculative truck terminal was not an easy task. Because nobody was building speculative truck terminals, because they are a little bit more known as special use properties within the spectrum. But there's been a lot of momentum on it. I think the market's kind of proven itself. And we're known as a leader, and getting to that early, recognizing that. And that's actually why we then went out and we recapitalized a portfolio of our properties. We had no partners, about 10 of them. And we went out and found an institutional partner with this business plan and said, hey, we feel we're a little ahead of the curve here, and we can show you our track record that we've been achieving strong returns in this sub-asset type within industrial. Do you believe in it? And therefore, when you recapitalize our portfolio, that gives us, we still stay as a managing member, but we give up some of the ownership. In return, we get some liquidity back so we can execute. And then since that time, about 2 years ago, I think we closed on that recapitalization the end of 2020, although we started buying iOS properties middle of 2020, but we've done about $1 billion of iOS since 2020 with this institutional partner. So that really allowed us, by bringing in a programmatic partner, to accelerate what we were doing. And now there's so many more people in it, which we foresaw coming, that we could kind of keep a step ahead as we saw that the competition would start increasing.
And what would you say, how much of the deal, or what percentage of your iOS deals are these quote unquote, I guess, covered land plays where you are entitling for this land for a much larger industrial intensive use?
Well, I mean, so with like a covered land play, it used to be we used to buy these yards and you would look at it when you call these yards, there's a covered land play. It's like, hey, let's get some income on this piece of dirt. And then down the road, we'll redevelop into a higher and better use. So initially, we were able to buy certain yards that weren't heavily improved, and that would be our plan. We're going to develop this into a distribution building down the road. In reality, what happened is the demand for these and the rental rates for these yards really increased. Mm-hmm. The numbers didn't look any better to go through all the work to go and build a new building when you're making really strong returns as a yard because the demand was really there. But nowadays, I try to position these with our capital partners, things saying, hey, no, this is a Class A trailer storage and maintenance yard. Don't look at it as much as a covered land play, because we had to go in and build this to the specs of what an institutional client like an Amazon, a FedEx, or UPS would want on that yard. We've got to go. You didn't used to have to go through a full, we have to submit a full development plan to the city like we would an industrial building. We've got to have setbacks and screen walls. We're building a drive-through maintenance buildings. And with Title 24 in California, which is, you know, green-focused initiatives in our building codes, you've got to have on-site water retention. Those cost millions of dollars in themselves. So now you've spent millions of dollars improving this piece of land into a Class A institutionally focused yard, meaning for institutional clients and institutional capital. And I go, gosh, it's no longer as much as a covered land play, because those yards aren't going to trade like they used to trade at kind of just land value. And now with the cost, there's millions of dollars of cost in those yards, you're not going to buy it. It won't really pencil to buy a heavily improved yard that these guys will pay a premium for to then, oh, I'm going to redevelop that in a couple of years for a distribution building. The economics don't make as much sense. It does maybe if you buy an old Class C yard, like they used to be built just with a chain link fence and, you know, and some gravel on there and so on. But there's not as much of those out there as much anymore.
Yeah.
And if we do buy those, we're generally taking those as we are right now. Like, for instance, up in Oakland, we're doing one where we're taking that, but we're converting it, and we had to go through the whole process. And, you know, we were like, do we have to do an EIR or a mitigated negative DAC? I think there we did a mitigated negative DAC and go through all the studies and so on, just to repurpose a Class C yard into a Class A yard. And this is where, and the institutions have come in where this is progressing. It used to just be everything's a yard and you look at those rates, but for industrial buildings, there's Class C, B, and A buildings that kind of lease for different rates. And we're now getting into place and we're trying to lead some efforts there for the market. Go, no, this is a Class A yard. And let me show you why it's a Class A compared to a Class B or a Class C yard, which should rent at different rates because there's been different costs put into these yards so that they're properly amenitized for the needs of today's leading edge transportation logistics companies that we spend a tremendous amount of time with, because most of them are now in our portfolio.
Yeah. No, it's interesting how this sub asset class has really taken off to such a widespread interest throughout all types of equity players, whether it's private capital, family offices, to the institutions. You've obviously have a ton of experience with truck terminals and other types of industrial development. And how would you characterize the ability to develop industrial in today's climate? Because in my experience, at least with respect to truck terminals, so many communities have said, not in our backyard. You're unable to, we don't want the Amazon trucks. We don't want the traffic. Our residents are not going to approve this. We need a different type of industrial, whether it's life science or something that produces more jobs. So how is developing today been in terms of those aspects?
Well, one thing that we've done is we've gotten very active in the communities that we're involved in, and so we really want to understand their viewpoint and also to know that we're a partner in their communities. So shout out to Jessica Pasula, our director of marketing and outreach, is really leads the charge that our whole company gets involved in to support a lot of local initiatives, supporting a lot of it in similar type based on what our foundation does, supporting inner city kids, are not all inner city, but supporting youth programs and programming. Even some, I think we're just right now making a donation to all the public trail system in one of the counties and cities that we're in. And this is important to us. We're the Southern California, Los Angeles, and so is where we all live and breathe. And we want to have active, vibrant, safe communities. So, and to show that we care, and it's important, I think, for all business people to do that. At the same point, yes. Because of the incredible growth of logistics type properties, let's say in areas like the Inland Empire, where there was a lot of land, a lot of this might have been, literally like out in Chino and things, were just big cow pastures and things like that, agricultural or various things. And now, you've got millions of square feet of these warehouses with a lot of truck traffic and things. So there are impacts. I think that legislatively, where I've always been involved, on the chapter board of NAIOP and things of that effect, you kind of saw this coming a bit. How do you prepare? And how do you also send the right message that we as an industry want to do the right things, and we want to have that right balance of, we're also providing a lot of jobs, and, the trucks and things out there that are clean diesel and a lot going to electric trucks. We're designing a lot of our buildings, with enough power and so forth so that they can, so they can plug in and things to that effect, and as well as the autos going to the facilities and solar on the roofs and drought resistant landscaping. So how we become that good partner for the communities that we're in a lot of different ways. But yes, in California compared to others, there are more regulatory hurdles. We've got our EIRs and MNDs that you've got to get through. It can be challenging. You're more apt to have your, even getting approvals on certain projects, you can then get challenged and sued and so on. So when you do get a project entitled, you've really created a fair amount of value, which is what I remind our development team at our platform is like, guys, yeah, it isn't easy. But we're driving a lot of value of getting through these entitlements. And I think also the easy sites, they say, might be gone, right? We were building at one point, let's say, an industrial building in the middle of a big industrial park or area, but now industrial is pushing maybe closer to where some of these residential are because the prime spots have all been built out. And so what do you want to do as a developer? How do you handle that as you get closer to residents? And that's where we get fairly involved with the communities and with the city. Now, hey, how do we put in the right access points so that the trucks come in through the right streets and the right areas, so we're mitigating the impacts, the right size screen walls, setbacks, mitigants and landscaping and things to that effect, so that we can be a good partner And so I think that's, but at the end of the day, yes, it has gotten more and more challenging to get through the approval process here. But let's say, what's a quote unquote benefit of that in this market? And why do we stay focused on Southern California and the Bay Area, which is also just as challenging, if not more challenging, actually, than Southern California with entitlements, as we've found out firsthand over the years. But, you know, here with these more restricted development environment, it makes it harder than to have an oversupply. So if you look at some other markets that we monitor closely, like Dallas right now, you might say Phoenix, what have you. Well, it's they do not have the same regulatory type environment that we have. And so right now I'd say Dallas is very oversupplied with industrial. Industrial is booming, a lot of land out there in Texas, and pretty, open-minded, your municipal communities to more development. And therefore, you know, you can easily get overdeveloped. And that's happened there. It keeps things a little more in check here when you can't get out quite the same amount of product that maybe would be developed if it was a little easier. So that always protects you when the economy slows down a tad.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue. And I know we have a few minutes left. Talk about the state of the industrial market. I mean, especially in today, obviously the economy has slowed down. Interest rates have risen significantly. Our transactional volume across the board has slowed down, and people are feeling pain. But, you know, vacancy rates are I would assume are still, you know, very, very small in industrial. But I guess talk about, you know, the overall health of the industrial asset class. And you probably need to be specific to California because of like what you just said, Phoenix and Dallas, they're experiencing different things and we're experiencing here.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I mean, there's a couple of examples or maybe a little oversupply, but overall, even like nationally, there's a pretty good supply demand balance. It's not heavily overbuilt if you look at it from just broadly throughout the country. But yeah, you know, here in Southern California, listen, we've had this incredible ride, I think via COVID and e-commerce. And then because there was all this lack of inventory, then corporate America wanted to carry more inventory. So then they need more warehouse space. And then there's more nearshoring, which creates a demand for more space because people are like, do we really want to manufacture in China? Labor's not as cheap and the product's stuck over there. We can't get it to our consumers. So all these various reasons have kind of kept driving this demand, which we don't think is slowing down considerably. So yes, when we're still getting our buildings leased here in California, in Southern California, we just, you know, signed a lease last year and so on. We've got various projects in different stages of development with active negotiations happening. I'd still say it's a much more cautious environment across the board. Tenants are being a little more cautious, reading the trade winds, and they're not, just before it was a frenzy. For the space and so much competition. All these tenants are just really 5-6 tenants competing for your building at the same time. You still have, I think it's more normalized conditions now, but everybody's got to watch it pretty carefully. I mean, year over year rents in the markets we're in are still up 20%. But at the same time, our cost of debt, even though we're conservative in underwriting, went up even more than people were expecting. It went up just because debt went up, I think, quicker and higher than I think almost anybody I know had was forecasting. And that obviously is also implicating the cap rates and so on. I mean, so it's, you know, your transactional volume on the sales side likely is going to go down because nobody really maybe wants to sell at a higher cap rate than they were projecting that would affect their ultimate returns. So, I mean, you know, I think we're all watching the economy headwinds. Yes, our lower vacancy here is helping, but still, in places like the Inland Empire, where there's land and there is more development out there than other areas, even here in Southern California, there's some markets that are more mature and more supply constrained because there's as much land to develop. The availability rate compared to vacancy rate, and the difference for your audience is that's including sublease space and other things. Availability rate is gone up a little bit. Tenants are trying to be a little more frugal, so they might go for that Class B building and get a little better rate or try to get that sublease on a shorter term, and some of that space is going to work its way through the system. And we're monitoring our competition and what's going up as we're launching new projects now and starting construction on some new projects. Of course, they won't complete for a year or so from now. So yeah, I still think it's going to be, you know, an interesting time. I think ultimately we're forecasting, hoping that, you know, I think the big picture industrial is still going to be continuing to be good demand. These are still good, healthy markets. I mean, Southern California, why are we here as well? We've got the largest ports in the country. We've got the seventh largest economy in the world in the state of, you know, California. We've got a huge population here. And so all of that, you know, means that this need for industrial product. But at the same point, yes, it is a little slower. Is it going to slow more and pick up a tad? I mean, that's what we're all literally watching on a daily basis. So
yeah,
everybody from our bankers, capital partners, ourselves, tenants, I mean, just constant, we're zeroing in, constant conversations every day.
And lawyers.
Things right. What's that?
And conversation with your lawyers. It is a daily fluid conversation. All right, second to last topic. Let's make these quick because I want to get you out of here in a couple minutes. What are you sitting in front of? Those of our audience need to see this instead of just hearing it on our audio podcast. So, Power Space Intelligence Power Solution. Space. Brett, are you gonna go with Richard Branson and fly out of orbit, or what is this?
You know, we're really fortunate, you know, to build. We're buying an office building in downtown Santa Monica that we're building out now. And this is some of the equipment that we'll have in there. I think a little red light wall got behind us as well, wherever it is there and things. But something I've just really gotten passionate about in my, you know, a lot of injuries in my collegiate sports career. And then even afterwards, some bad ski accidents and things and learning how to recover right. I just have a love for health, fitness, and wellness. Really want to make that part of our culture. And so in our office building, we're building it out with hyperbaric chambers and cold compression machines. And on the rooftop, we're going to have the ice bath and infrared sauna. And, you know, we're going to have an altitude training room that, altitude is a big thing where these oxygen masks, so you can train up to like 25,000 feet, like the height of Everest, which gives you a lot of performance boost. So, it's just, I'm passionate about, I think certain people in our company are as well. And I really want to share that with all those people that we work with, and as well as our family and friends have a facility nearby that we don't, and you know, when you're, I call it kind of human optimization. And so it's like, hey, when you're feeling great and everybody in your company's feeling energized and you know, and people can come visit you, I'll have my meetings. This fits four people. So I'll go next time we have a meeting or a podcast, we'll be in the hyperbaric chamber.
I love it.
Had meetings and people, and if you want to catch up, I'm cool. Just jump in the chamber.
By the way, Brett, if you don't like their terms, you don't unlock the door.
It's true.
You only unlock the door until they agree to your terms. This is perfect.
That's a good one. We bring those bankers in.
Yeah.
So that's something you get it. It's something I'm passionate about. And I also feel in today's world, I want to make it where everyone in our company, you want to come to the office. Like I've got all these neat modalities and equipment that you won't even find at a typical gym or even at your home. So I think what I'm finding is my team, like they're excited, so excited about the build out, what we're doing. And even a lot of our partners, that was one of our big capital partners up in San Francisco over the weekend at a retreat there with them. And they would like wanted me to give a little talk just on all these red light therapy and all things I'm doing. They're like, well, we can't wait to come down and visit and let's spend more time with you. We should talk about other business we're doing together, because this drives it, you know, you kind of crazy, another reason, another connection point to kind of, hey, let's do business with each other, but let's have a fun time and let's be healthy.
Yeah, completely. You mix both things. So business and health, wellness, exercise. I love it. Next time I come over to either your house or your office, we'll meet in the hyperbaric.
I'll lock you in there just like you recommended.
Done. All right. Last thing. We got the U.S. Open this week. You're a member of L.A. I'm a member of Brentwood. You know, Brentwood passed on hosting the Open, so we gave it to you guys. So thanks for being a steward of this unbelievable tournament. No, it's I've never been more excited for a golf tournament. I'm sure everyone in L.A. is talking about going. So I guess my last question on this podcast, who's your prediction? What's your prediction of who's going to win and what score?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's, there's a few guys I like out there. I'm fans of, from Rory to Justin Thomas and so on. love to see have a good performance out there. I mean, hey, Brooks has been playing well. You think the guy's going to be in contention to just step it up for these majors and so on. Could Phil finally win the U.S. Open? He does get out there to L.A. more. I've seen him out there more than other pros.
Yeah.
As we've seen a lot more of him out there over the last, year or two playing. You know, you look at Riviera, that's similar to L.A. as far as the same golf course designer, a lot of similarities. They don't light up Riviera in L.A. In my opinion about it, you can make tougher. It was his George C. Thomas's jewel in the crown, as I like to remind my buddies at Bel Air Country Club in Riviera, in his book that he wrote. So just about me saying it was him. But it's a phenomenal course. I think it's great for the city of L.A. And a lot of people who've never seen this spectacular track.
Yeah.
And I think that they can, and we're seeing it. I mean, the roughs, like they do at all U.S. Opens, but they're able to do it at LACC, which is why I think they wanted to have it there. I mean, the rough is itchy. It's deep for us normal hackers on the weekends, and it is twice as deep. I mean, some of the pin positions, you can't really go after the greens or the pins, or even on the putting. So if you go aggressively after a putt and miss, and it's going to roll 30, 40 feet away. So I don't think anybody's going to go super low. I mean, if somebody went 10, 12 under, I think that'd be pretty low. I mean, I think the USGA tries to make it so you're only maybe a few under par. But I don't know. I'd probably see somebody 5 to maybe 10 under that wins it. A few guys, I think, that are capable of doing it. So it's going to be a blast. I'm going to be there every day. I know we're going to see you at the box one day. And there's going to be a huge presence of the L.A. real estate community. It seems I know there's going to be out there, too. So same with me. I haven't been a member of L.A. a long time. Shoot, this got announced 7-8 years ago. I remember in 2017 or 18, 23 seemed like forever. I thought it'd be like just an old man in a wheelchair, it seemed like. But here we are coming. It is happening now, the practice rounds. It's pretty darn exciting. And I think for all of us to see a course we all know pretty well, if we play golf here in LA and play it a fair amount, to see what these guys can do to these holes that we find extremely difficult, these guys will probably light up.
I know.
Pretty amazing.
It's going to be great to see. You didn't make a pick, but that's okay. I'm going with Max Homa. He won at RIV. He won at RIV, or was close to winning at RIV. He won at Torrey. I think he won at LA before.
Record at LA. I think it was, Walker Cup or the NCAAs. He shot like a 61.
Yep, that's what I heard.
I think they used his super yield round. The USGA took note of that, of where they needed to toughen up the course, because nobody saw him shooting a 61. I heard he just played lights out that day. I didn't actually get to see that. They're talking about a great guy, great for the golf, a great man for the game of golf, just such a great attitude and funny guy. That's a great pick, local boy.
Yeah, that's what I'm going with. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you out there. Thanks for having me. And it's going to be a great event for the entire community and golf. And Brett, I just want to thank you for coming on. The Dado family name is legendary, multiple generations. What you do, not just in real estate and in business, but in for the community, for charity, your foundation. So I just thank you as a Los Angelino, thank you. And also for just coming onto the show. I appreciate it.
No, hey, I appreciate it. Hey, we all do our part. I know you do too. And I think that's important. We've all been blessed with success. And I think doing things like this, sharing it, helping other people. And that's what my hope in being on this is that, hey, we can inspire that next round of leaders to have success and to give back and be a valuable part of the community. It's so important. So, thanks, Andrew.
All right. I'll see you at the Open. And then next time, Hyperbaric Chamber.
Okay. You got it, buddy.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.